Recalibration Matrix is sponsored by Discount Games Inc. and Muzon Minis. Discount Games Inc. offers the maximum allowed discount on Marvel Crisis Protocol. When you order $30 or more, you will receive free domestic shipping. Visit us at www.discountgamesinc.com. Muzon Minis creates the highest quality gaming accessories. You can buy our product at www.museonstore.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of Recalibration Matrix. I'm one of your hosts, Jay Larson. Joining me, as every episode is going to, is Greg Webster. Hello, Greg.
Hey, Jay. How are you?
I am doing well.
Good.
So, with this being our first episode, I thought that during our intro here, we'd spend a little bit of time talking about what we're wanting to do with the podcast and what people can expect. So, each episode, we're going to have a main episode where we pick a character from Marvel Crisis Protocol, and we will have two segments of the podcast. One is going to be focused on the gameplay, some gameplay discussion about that character in Marvel Crisis Protocol. And then the second part is going to be basically a comic book club. And one of the things that's nice about this podcast is that my co-host here, Greg, knows quite a bit about comic books. And so he is going to curate a fun list of comics for us to read together. And then Greg and I will have a discussion about it. And our hope is that we will let you guys know about the comics that we're going to cover in advance, and you guys can hopefully have a chance to read those comics and have it be kind of a feel like you're part of the discussion that we're having when we are going over these comics. So Greg, why don't we maybe have you tell a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Greg, obviously. I worked for comic shops most of my way through college. I needed a job I could work at night, and it turns out that Austin had a lot of really great comic shops with flexible hours. And so for about 4 years, I was working at comic shops, and when I graduated, I moved on. But even before then, though, like, I had been reading mostly Marvel comics from like a really young age. It's always been one of the things that like I'm constantly coming back to. And like just working at comic shops pretty much full time through college really like cemented my love for the silly and specialness of like superhero comics.
Yeah, so a little bit about myself. This is not my first podcast. I've done a few other podcasts. One is Chain Attack. It's been going for probably 7 or 8 years at this point. And it was popular enough that we did a subscription podcast with it called The Dojo. And then recently, I've been doing another podcast called The Meta that is basically me interviewing different people in the War Machine community. I am around 12 years ago, 13 years ago, something like that, I started my own business with called Discount Games Inc. I have a physical game store, that friendly local game store, that I run the website discountgamesinc.com out of. And I've been doing that for about 12 years, and it was because of selling War Machine online was my introduction into miniature gaming. I had never really played miniature games before that point. I had done a lot of cards and board games and things like that before then. And this is during my career as a retailer. I've obviously sold many different miniatures games, but this is the first one that since War Machine that I've been really, really excited about. And I'm sure part of that is that I'm friends with several of the designers that created this game, and also a lot of those designers were people who worked on War Machine, which is a game that I love. And so that has, you know, piqued my interest in this game. And it's actually through War Machine that Greg and I got connected with each other. One of our mutual friends is the lead developer, designer for Crisis Protocol, Will Pagani. And actually, when I was chatting some with Will, I told him that I was wanting to do a podcast about his game, and we were kind of discussing formats and balancing ideas, etc. And one of the things that he said was that he thought that it would be interesting to focus some on comics, and that he thought that Greg would make a great co-host because he knew so much about comics.
And yeah, he probably just recommended me so that I would stop texting him ideas, though, honestly. So, Will, and just to bounce off you, Will was the owner of my friendly local gaming store before he moved into the world of game development and ended up with Atomic Mass Games making Marvel Crisis Protocol. So Will was, you know, he was my Jay Larson before he abandoned me. it was Will who like hooked us up together. And you know, before then we had met at a couple War Machine tournaments. Just Lock and Load. My schedule, you know, I teach fourth grade, and my schedule is kind of summers only for big tournaments. I'm really excited. And Jay, it is really nice to know that like people we trust like are shepherding a game in. I'm really excited about this game. Like every single thing about it just gets me like excited and tingly, and I think it's such a cool cinematic comic book game that how could I not be all in on this?
Yeah, I'm really excited for it. I'm excited for this podcast. One of the things that's kind of been a barrier for me with comics is that it's kind of like there's this ocean of material, and it can kind of make it a little bit difficult to approach sometimes.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm excited to have you help give me some reading lists to learn more about these different characters and these different storylines. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Good. I'm really excited. I gotta say, like, on a personal level, like, I miss working at comic book shops in large part because, you know, just getting someone into a good story and like introducing them to something really fun is like one of the best parts about working at that job. So this is going to be really fun. I'm really excited for our like our story arcs and our dives and getting into the game and connecting it. It's going to be really cool.
Awesome. So our next segment, are usually in our main episode, our first segment is going to be talking about the game aspects of the character that we have selected. But for our first episode, we have an interview with Will Pagani and Will Schick. And so we're going to be splicing this in here, and it's going to run longer than what our normal first episode would sound like or last. Usually our first episode is likely going to be around 45 or 50 minutes, and I'm pretty sure that's around what the interview was. And so this is going to be an extra double length feature on this podcast. And then once the interview's done, we'll go ahead and we'll do our normal comic book discussion, and we'll proceed from there.
Can't wait.
Okay, so I'm really excited for this next segment. We have the opportunity to chat with two of my favorite Wills in the entire world, one Will Pagani and Will Schick. How are you doing, guys?
We're doing great. How are you doing, Jay?
I'm awesome. So thank you guys very much for taking the time out to do this interview with us. We definitely appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you for having us on.
Awesome. So we've got some questions to go through with you guys, and we're excited to hear what you guys have to say about things. So a lot of the questions we have go into the design process of creating this game. And the first one we have is, what did you guys do to evoke the feeling of comic books while you were designing this game?
I mean, the big thing was when I started on the initial design with the project, like having read comics for a long, long time in my life. Like I started reading when I was 6. Like to me, the big fundamental things were there needed to be an interactive environment. Because you always see superhero battles with things getting thrown around, things getting smashed, things getting destroyed. So bringing that kind of kinetic energy to the tabletop was really important. And then the other big thing was making sure that the characters felt like the characters themselves. And I think part of that is really rewarding players for getting to do the big, impressive things. And that's kind of where the power system came from. So having a system where as you play the game, as you do the things you're supposed to do, you're going to get rewarded with a mechanic that basically allows you to do even better and cooler things. To me, it was really exciting and kind of really evoked how the ebb and flow of those big climactic Marvel battles go. You know, you don't start off with your biggest attack ever to end the fight in one punch. Instead, you kind of fiddle around and you punch each other and you throw some cars. And then right at the moment where you're going to fail, that's when you unleash the best and the strongest attack that you might have. And so it was kind of designing in elements that helped tell a narrative that was similar to what you see in the comics and to really drive up excitement while also giving players kind of that choice to tell the story the way they want to tell it.
That's awesome.
One of the things that I appreciate about the game is I've looked through some of the preview cards and things that you guys have teased is that it's felt like you've done a really good job of trying to create superpowers that make you feel like you're actually playing that superhero. And so I guess what was that, I guess, process kind of like when you were trying to create the superpowers that matched the superheroes?
Like that kind of is the secret sauce, I think, of the whole game design, because there was a lot of yin and yang. Like I grew up reading comics and loving like the characters, and Pagani's relatively new to the Marvel universe. And so as the design process would go, I would come up with all these ideas for the characters, and I would kind of write an overall document where it's like, he should be able to do this, or Captain Marvel needs to be able to absorb energy attacks. And I'd do my best to kind of like write what I thought the rule should be. And then I'd go and I'd argue with Pagani about why that rule needed to stay, and he had to change like something else in the rules to make it work. But Pagani, I'm sure, can talk about it more from his side.
I mean, a lot of the times, Chick would come in with a document, kind of as he said, where it has some specific stuff and some nebulous stuff. But usually it would be too much for a character, or he would have some other ideas where it's like, there would be little notes off the side that would be like, we could do things like this or that kind of stuff. And then it was really picking, because I don't have a huge comic background, when I'm like, oh, this feels like Spider-Man, you know that like everyone's going to feel that it feels like Spider-Man, because right. I don't particularly know a lot about Spider-Man, whereas I think we could get too specific with some characters. But nailing these feelings and kind of picking and choosing through the iconic abilities of each of these characters, I think is a really important part of it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of just, you know, ebb and flow and back and forth discussions. And Pagani would come in and say, well, I think we need a character that can do more of this. And I'd be like, okay, well, that would fit really well for like a Baron Zemo, or fit really well for a Star-Lord. And then we'd go off and we'd kind of write that stuff. And so it was, you know, it's very much kind of a, you find the things that are iconic to the characters, and those characters also kind of develop their own niche based on that. And there's a lot of different ways you can go, obviously, because there's, you know, 80 years of Marvel history and a number of different creative teams, and every single creative team puts their kind of own mark on those characters. So you have a lot to pull from. You have a wealth of information to pull from, and everybody has their favorite stuff. So it's kind of identifying the core stuff and then picking the things that really felt right for the game.
Well,
go ahead.
I would assume as well that where you are trying to, like you said, you can't represent on the character sheet basically everything that the character can do in the comics, and picking kind of the things that are a little bit of a focus. It seems like it gives you also a good opportunity when you decide it's time to make a future character of the same character, that you have more things to explore or other things to powers to be able to play with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the really exciting things is that not only do you have this huge pantheon of amazing characters, you also have the opportunity to revisit characters and do a beloved costume, like the symbiote costume for Spider-Man, right? That's an iconic one. How many different marks of armor does Iron Man have? Like a bazillion, right? So it's really fun to know that that potential is there and be able to kind of plan that out. And it also makes you feel, I mean, from my standpoint, it makes me feel really happy because like Spider-Man, for example, you know, we could have gone in a million different directions, but kind of the core role that we identified for him early on was that disruptive, harassing like character who is really hard to pin down and then messes with you a lot, right? Like he pulls your characters in, he pushes your characters away, he throws things at you, and then he like Spider-Man flips out of the way and you can't really like catch him. And I think that's a great and iconic, like it very much feels like Spider-Man. Like in the comics, he's making jokes. He's really making his opponents angry. He's doing all the things to just be kind of this obnoxious, like tight character that's pulling everyone away, in order to defeat you, like to defeat powerful characters that way. But we could have easily gone in a different direction and made a more melee centric Spider-Man or made, someone who is really focused on grabbing objectives, saving civilians, and that kind of stuff. And so that was one of those like moments where it was like, okay, let's define our role, and then let's just find those aspects that the character has that make them feel like the character, but fill that role as well.
So, Greg, I've been dominating the questions. Why don't you go ahead and shoot one to the team?
Absolutely. So, obviously, Marvel Crisis Protocol has a lot of moving pieces, different heroes, and of course, you know, future-proofing the game. So my next question is, what was the biggest challenge you guys were making Crisis Protocol?
So the biggest challenge for me is sort of simplicity where we can and sort of finding ways to remove complication from the game. So we've taken all these moving parts that you mentioned, and we've really like picked and chosen the ones that we really, really like. And those are sort of brought to the forefront of the game itself. So things like high mobility characters moving around, constantly attacking, constantly interacting with your objectives. And then the things that we didn't necessarily deem quite as important, so things like climbing buildings and stuff, were boiled down to their base essence and implemented into the game because they are important, but we don't really want to bring them to the forefront of the system. And that was something that was really difficult for me because I'm like one of those guys who loves really super crunchy games. So I'm like, shit, we need like a way for Hulk to throw a dumpster through a building to hit a guy, and the chick's like, Doran's like, okay, maybe not that one, but like finding those complex situations and then sort of boiling them down to their essence and creating an easy system for people to move through where they don't feel like they're being hampered by the rules. They get to experience them and play with them.
Yeah, I think I would largely agree, right? I think the challenge always was the fact that we wanted a game that was both tactically deep and complex, and yet also super fast, super fun, and very easy to pick up. And so a lot of that, like Pagani mentions, just comes down to where do you spend your currency, right? If you imagine that you have this amount of like complexity money to spend, and all these items cost a different amount, how are you going to dole out that money and not go over budget, right? And so once we identified kind of what that budget was, it was, okay, where do we want to spend that? Where are we going to go a little further or push a little harder? And where do we need to pull back? And that was, you know, that was definitely a conversation. But I think the nice thing was is that overall, everybody on the team had such a great initial vision for what the game was and what we wanted it to be that, you know, it was almost natural that we were able to just identify where we had gone too far. And then we worked really hard to come back and bring it to a point to where we're like, okay, this feels right.
Okay, so what character did you guys enjoy the creation process on the most?
I think for me, the one out of the initial wave that I liked the most was probably MODOK. And one of the reasons for that was, so MODOK has kind of an interesting story. Like, we worked really closely with the Marvel team, and we still obviously do. And they're a fantastic resource and sounding board. And so when we were initially pitching the initial, like, waves of the characters, we were trying to find a counterpoint to Hulk. And we had a number of different names, and Marvel kind of zoned in, and they're like, well, MODOK, we think MODOK would be a really great inclusion. And I was like, MODOK, how in the heck do you do MODOK? Like, I love that guy from Marvel Superhero Squad, and he's very iconic to the whole, like, villain AIM, like, sector. But I was like, I don't, how do you do, like, a giant floating head in a chair? And so it was really fun to kind of like dive in and make him our first mystic based character, and also to kind of explore what does telekinesis mean in our game? What does telepathy mean in our game? Like mind control. He opened up a whole lot of, I think, groundbreaking ways forward in how we viewed characters that came later, like Loki, and some of the other characters that are more mental or mystical based. So he was just fun. And plus getting to name everything MODOK style was just awesome. Like, I think that's when I started to really make Pagani question his choices, because he always has problems with my name.
Oh, the one, what is it? It's like imbecile. And then it like, yeah they're hilarious.
Yeah, it's imbecile. MODOK's genius is infinite, and then there's
all
like
the world
all the world is a weapon is to MODOK. Yeah, there's so many great ones on that. It was just I just got to dive in and just be like, what would MODOK name his stuff? And I think that's another fun part about creating the characters is we get a lot of fun leeway to kind of inject that flavor into the names that we get to choose.
Yes, we do. I'm over here rubbing my eyes. You took mine. I was gonna do MODOK, but I'm gonna do Hulk for my one. That was a great sort of faint design. Hulk doesn't have an injured side, and that was weird in terms of game design, right? Because we built in this injury system where characters can't get KO'd in one round, and you kind of always get to do your cool thing because of that injury system. And then immediately in wave one, we break that system, and I think that is great. Because I think it'll show people kind of like we're willing to think outside the box and stuff. But actually working on Hulk was really interesting because he started off with a healthy and an injured side originally. And he basically had the same rules he has now. He had a couple different things that had to get changed for balance purposes. But generally speaking, he had the same rules. And it created some really weird situations where like you would daze him and then he would lose all of his damage. And then he would lose all of his damage tokens. And then his superpower that gives him bonus attack dice based on how much damage he has would kind of like reset, which Hulk doesn't reset. Like Hulk only goes one direction. Like, so that created like a really weird situation for us. And this is sort of how we got around that situation, I guess, where we ended up with a high stamina character with no injured side. And we talked a lot about different things that we could do with an injured side, like banner or something, but we ended up deciding that wasn't really the direction to go for Hulk. And I don't know, there's a lot of really interesting choices to be made for that character, and how he sort of shaped up, I think is pretty much perfect. I'm really excited for him.
Well, I really like the idea of you breaking one of your like core character rules in the very beginning to kind of show that you're willing to do that and be more creative with the design.
Yeah, like I think game design in general is about setting up boundaries and being like, this is the box that we're going to play in. But I think anytime that you can kind of like poke a little hole in that box and create something really cool and interesting, it's something that you should try to do, because that I think is a lot of the flair that comes into like really exciting games is when you don't have that standard.
So we had later on another question on MODOK, but I think we'll have Greg go ahead and hit you guys with that right now since we're on that topic.
Are we doing number five?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was the thought process behind including a, you know, really obscure character like MODOK at launch? And you kind of touched on it, Will, but or Schick, if you couldn't go deeper into that, because MODOK is very like he's used very sparingly, especially in like big team up events for Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think like there were a couple of one, like I said before, right? It was kind of a Marvel suggestion, right? As we were talking about the characters and who was going to go where and stuff. For me, though, like part of that and part of the reason that I'm very happy he's there is that I think on one hand, MODOK is uniquely Marvel. Like you see that guy and you're just like, what is this? And there's nothing else like MODOK. And so I think that's kind of cool. And then the other thing that I really like, and I worked on this with the core set characters as well, when kind of designing and picking the characters that we're going to go into that to present to Marvel, is like Cross Villains and Baron Zemo are two kind of villain characters that in comics are pretty well known. Like Baron Zemo is significant. He's been an adversary to Captain America in two different forms, right? We have his son and we have the second Baron Zemo in our game to Captain America's foil. But like, so he has kind of like this really big renown in the comics, but if you've only watched or come to Marvel from some of the other media, like the cartoon or maybe the movies or other things, which I think is great, you might not be as familiar with that character. And so it was really important to kind of show that not only were we going to hit all of the touchstone characters, that we were going to get the big names, you know, your Iron Man, your Spider-Man, your Ultron, your Red Skulls, but that the game itself really wants to, like, if the goal for us is to draw from the comics. We're pulling from that Marvel universe. And anytime that we can kind of introduce people to a new character that they might not know, and through the game rules, through the sculpt of the miniature, get people interested to want to know more, I think that's awesome, right? To me, that's an amazing goal. So to have MODOK kind of at the front, I think, one, it makes people stop. And they either go, oh my gosh, they put MODOK in. I love MODOK. Nobody ever talks about MODOK. That's amazing. Or they go, what the heck is that guy? I must find out more. And so, like, either way, right, I feel like that's a huge benefit. It's a huge win. And I think it's just fun. I think it lends to the fact that the game is not taking itself super serious. Like, it is living in that Marvel universe of excitement, of inspiration, awe, and just fun. So that to me is kind of like the logic and the reasoning behind MODOK, and why I'm excited that he actually is in that first run of characters for sure.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was interesting with it is that it definitely, having him in the first wave of releases, it kind of lets the customer know that this isn't just focused on the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There's going to be more that we can explore. And I think that that's, you know, something that's good for the customer to be aware of at the from the outset.
Yeah. I hope that it really sets the stage for the fact that, you know, the game is based primarily on the comic books, and we're really excited to kind of dive in and explore and throw things out there. So,
okay, well, continuing on the theme of MODOK, we want you guys to talk to us about Recalibration Matrix, which is the namesake of this awesome podcast.
Well, Recalibration Matrix is one of the tactic cards from the MODOK set. Mm-hmm. And are we...
You know, go for it.
We're
go
spoiling?
For it. Yeah, go for it.
All right. Recalibration Matrix is a tactic card that is played... It's a reactive card that is played after all attack dice have been rolled, all attack and defense dice, and it lets you re-roll everything in play. So it's essentially kind of like a reset button. You don't, like, go back and re-roll your whole attack in terms of, like, criticals and triggers and stuff, but it does let you re-roll all the dice, which is kind of cool, and it's kind of chaos-y. if you don't roll particularly well and they roll particularly well, you get a whole lot of value out of it, maybe. Or maybe they just roll well again and you don't. So it's this sort of, like, MODOK mad science reset with electricity button.
Yeah, okay. And it can also be really interesting based on the number of criticals you roll, because you're going to add extra dice potentially than you had before, and then fails, obviously, you still can't re-roll, so it definitely has a very unique effect on the game. But it's a great card to have in your back pocket when you're just like, well, I rolled really poorly, I want to do that again.
I love it. And do you have to have MODOK to play that card?
You do not. Any character can play Recalibration Matrix.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And I think it's a great name, so well done, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Thank you. What do you guys enjoy the most about working at Atomic Mass Games? It's a newer studio, and you're probably a tight-knit group right now. But how have you guys been feeling about it? What is the most fun thing?
I'm just gonna stare at Pagani as he answers now.
Yeah. Give me the eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
I like how everyone is kind of involved everything, because we are such a small studio at the moment. Like, when Dallas gets in a sculpt, he'll kind of pull everyone into his computer monitor and be like, well, what do you think of this? Or like when I'm working on a character or a mission or something, and I can be like, cool guys, well, what do you think about this kind of stuff? Or like, I have a couple different options for something, which ones do you all like? And that like, I think that kind of builds like a sense of ownership almost, right? Like, oh, I helped out with we sculpted Loki or whatever, because I mentioned this thing and that made it into the sculpt. Or Josh really liked this particular civilian token or something, so we were able to put that into the token sheet for a character. So I think it's that really personalized, like, everyone gets to influence everything and really sort of drive it in the direction that they think is best. And at the moment, we're small enough to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree a lot with kind of Pagani's assessment. Like, one of the big things when we started Atomic Mass was that we kind of laid down our foundational studio, like, rules, right? Our kind of mantra. And one of those big ones was we believe in creation through collaboration. So, like, even when we get bigger, right, there are no islands. There's everything gets better if you have more input. And obviously, at some point, somebody has to make a decision, and you can't make everyone happy. But the fact of the matter is that if you involve everybody and everybody gets to be passionate about what they're doing, they have a lot more ownership of what they're doing. And, you know, we've got a lot of talent. We have a lot of really smart people. And just because Pagani is a great, you know, developer doesn't also mean that he doesn't have a good eye for spotting things in a sculpt or on a frame for a miniature that's going to get put together that isn't going to be valuable, right? So isolating people and kind of being like, no, this is mine, you can't touch it, it just leads to, you know, a lesser environment and a lesser product. And I think that overall, that's been one of the most exciting things. And I think the other thing that I really love about the place is that everybody here is just so passionate and so in love with what we do that, you know, and that's miniatures games specifically, that it's just fun. You know, you get to come in and you get to hang out with people who want to be nowhere else, right? This is their thing. And then we get to work on Marvel on top of it. So it's just like, it doesn't get much better. I don't know, like maybe, but it's just amazing. It's amazing to watch everybody just kind of, you know, take the opportunities that they have, always push forward, right? Everybody's always fighting to be better and better and better. It's the only place that I can really think of where like you can make amazing things one week and then the next week you're like, those things were terrible. We can make better things. And I love that. I love that about the team, and I love that about the place. And it's just, you know, it's just an awesome environment. So
that's awesome. And it sounds like you guys have, you know, a really amazing team and a lot of positive energy. So like, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, we're blessed enough to have a pretty awesome crew, and like I said, everybody here just, you know, we're all miniatures guys. We all love miniatures games. That's what we do. It's what we want to do, and we just want to make the best miniatures and the best, you know, games to go along with them that we can.
Very cool.
So, what trends do you guys currently see happening within miniature game design?
Sorry, you'll have to repeat the question because Pagani's phone was ringing.
Oh, no.
I need that reminder for something. It's too late now, though. The question was, what trends do we see happening in miniature game design? I mean, I see things getting smaller. So lower model or miniature count games are becoming more popular. Easier, more accessible games are becoming more popular. You're starting to see a lot more sort of randomization in games. So people are getting away from that chess or go idea and are getting into more card drawing, dice rolling, things like that. And I think what a lot of those do is they bring in sort of a more accessible game and a more, I'm going to say casual, and I don't mean that in an offensive way because I know some people get upset at being called a casual. But I think what it does is it allows people that wouldn't normally be able to play miniature games to really be able to start accessing them. Maybe accessible instead of casual is the right word to use there. And that's kind of what I see in terms of the new games that are coming out. And I think we're a part of that as well. I think we're doing basically all of those things.
Yeah, I think the, you know, the current trend right now with games in general, but especially on the miniature side, is that you have a lot of interest, but people's time is more and more strapped, right? Like hobbies are harder to do, and a miniatures game is a full-time hobby. It consumes a lot of stuff. Like you get to put your miniatures together, you get to paint them, you get to play games with them, you get to learn how to be better at the game, to learn how to be better at the hobby, you get to build tables. Like all of that stuff, you know, adds up. And so when people see it and then they think about like all the other demands on their schedule, all the other demands on their time now, all the other things you could be doing, it's like, okay, well, I really want to do this, but I also want to see success, right? I want to see success with putting the miniatures together. I want to see success with painting them. I want to see success with playing. And I think that's where that kind of streamline comes in, where, you know, smaller miniature count game, you now can spend more time on the hobby, but less time at the same time. You know, the games are faster. You can play more. You can get more enjoyment out of what you do on the tabletop during your limited game nights. Like all that stuff kind of combines together to say, okay, I want to be great at this, but I also need it to work within kind of the demands of a modern time. And so that's kind of, I think, the trend, right? Nobody wants to have to do hours or very, I shouldn't say nobody, very few people now have the time or the ability to spend, you know, days and days and days really mapping something out or thinking about all the strategies or doing a lot of practice, right? Like that professional level of gaming is kind of, it's still there. And I think it still occupies an important level of, you know, the industry in general, but it's not what everybody does now, right?
And it's not what everybody wants. And so I think that's kind of like where you're seeing the trend of, like Pagani said, a more accessible, while still being, you know, balanced and deep and rewarding. And I think that's the real trick, right? And that's, you know, that's the secret magic. If you can find a game that is accessible and people can pick up really quick, but that doesn't sacrifice all the things that people love about miniatures games, then you're in a really good spot.
And I think that kind of ties back into what we're talking about, our complexity and stuff, right? Like, we wanted to hit the points, like, what are the important things to players? What do they want? We tried to hit all of those points, and I think we succeeded, while also creating an accessible game that a large number of people can play if they so choose.
Can you build on that? Can you go into maybe if somebody sees Crisis Protocol and some similar, you know, number of models style game, and they say these look really similar, could you go into like what sets Crisis Protocol apart from those other mini games?
I mean, I think fundamentally we had three pillars that kind of defined the experience they were trying to do. The first was the dynamic mission and team building. So going back kind of to the idea of, you know, the hobby time and seeing success with that, right? With Crisis Protocol, we very specifically set out to say, okay, there are no factions. There are no artificial factions. And if you look at the Marvel Universe, there have been team-ups by everyone at any point in time, whether in an alternate universe or in the 616 universe or anything like that. So why limit people? Also, why should I tell you that if you love Spider-Man and you love Ronan the Accuser, you can't use them together in your dream with Marvel stuff, right? So we got rid of that. And then what we did was, we made a dynamic mission and a dynamic like squad building part of the game. So you're going to come to a table with a certain amount of resources and a list that you have, but you're not going to know all the parameters. And then you and your opponent together are going to create a mission, and then you're going to build a squad from that. And so this allows you to kind of take that collection, collect the characters that you want, collect all the characters that you want, paint them at your speed, and know that if something sparks your interest, you can grab that right away and put it right in your list. You're not going to have to wait to paint a whole bunch of other things or hobby a whole bunch of other things to be able to play with the characters that are currently interesting, right? The other one is the power mechanic, and that comes back to giving players choices, allowing them the ability to kind of influence the game, but also it provides a really great way to put a catch-up mechanic in the game. So if your opponent does really well and you start to get pummeled, you don't have to worry as much about it because you're going to get to do so much stuff on your next turn. It's going to be awesome. It's very exciting. And like, it's going to give you that chance to kind of catch up. And then the third one is the interactive environment, right? Being able to destroy the battlefield, to throw it around, all that stuff. I think those are the things, like, from a gameplay perspective that specifically jump out and say, this game is different. From like a specific one-to-one rules, right? It all just comes down to, the idea that everything has kind of been done to incentivize the fun, the action, and the speed of the game in terms of like the pace on the table, and not get bogged down into kind of z-axis and all that other kind of stuff that makes it feel like reality is on the tabletop. Like, we've accepted that reality is not the tabletop. This is, you know, it's a game, it's an abstraction, and we want it to be fun. So that's, you know, that's kind of our view on it. And Pagani could probably add some stuff too if
you want. I mean, I think you did it really well, honestly. Like, I think army construction is a big thing. And I talked a little bit earlier about like randomizing scenarios and things like that, which you can totally do in Crisis Protocol if you want. But we've built in this system of the roster system. But if you just wanted to draw two random scenarios and play it, you can do that. Like Crisis, I guess, if you do the wrong word. I mean, I think you got it. Got it in one.
I get paid this week.
Jay, do you want to go next?
Sure. So what do you guys think sets Crisis Protocol apart from other miniature games?
That was what we just asked.
Oh, I thought you asked a different variation.
I rephrased it. Sorry.
Oh, how am I to know these things? Sorry. So what part of Crisis Protocol are you most proud of?
I think, so recently I was at the Nova Open, and it was kind of the first time that I really got to talk with people that were playing the demos and really had just experienced the game. And seeing like a dad and their kid playing Crisis Protocol, and both of them with just huge smiles on their face, just like screaming and yelling as dice were getting rolled and that kind of stuff, like that to me was like a moment of just like pure joy and happiness and that kind of thing. Like it, I don't know, it felt incredible to me. And that's something that I'm really proud of, that I was able to be part of a team that brought that happiness and that joy to someone else. Maybe I didn't explain that very well.
No, that was perfect.
But like that, I think is the biggest moment where I was like, man, we really did something awesome here. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I think like, I kind of agree, right? Since we started developing and designing the game and stuff, like even when I showed the initial design to like Pagani in Dallas and we started looking at it and, you know, they were like, I think this could be really good. I was like, okay, that's great. And then the more we moved through, the more excited people got, and people who had no stake in the project, when they see it, they would get really excited. And then all of a sudden they'd be like, oh, I got to go start reading like this character's like comic line, or this reminds me of this. Like, and then going to Gen Con and seeing all of the, like the parents and, you know, their teenagers and all that stuff. And just seeing people respond so positively to like the game, and the fact that it gave them the Marvel experience that they always wanted, and that, you know, everything about the experience was fun, and they were like, that to me was just like, it was pretty awesome. Because, you know, the only thing that I ever want is to just bring more people into like things that they're going to love, right? And for me, that's miniatures hobbies and a little bit Marvel. So if our game makes you go, you know what, these miniature games are really cool, and all of a sudden like you're in, then that's amazing. And if the game goes, man, I totally love like Marvel, but I never knew about this character, and now I'm going to go read more about this character because the game world is really cool, like that's awesome too, right? Just growing the community in general of both miniatures games and like nerddom, to me, there's nothing better than that. And so to be a part of something that has the potential and certainly has done that for the people that have seen it so far, like, is phenomenal. You know, it's extremely humbling and it's pretty awesome.
No, that's awesome. And I really like how both of your answers kind of touched on like the joy and like spreading that fun to the players. So that's really sweet. So our next question is that a lot of players dream of working in the gaming industry. Do you guys have any advice to help people that are looking to break into it or start their careers?
I mean, you got to get lucky, right? Like to be completely honest, you got to get lucky. It's a small industry, right? Like there's just not a lot of jobs. But I think my advice is don't ever stop trying, and get involved where you can. Apply for jobs, right? Like you're going to think, hey, I'm not good enough for this job. That doesn't matter. Apply for the job. Like what you think you're good enough for doesn't matter. The hiring person is the person that has to think you're good enough. So if you're a game designer, go out, play your games, learn about game design, go to conferences about game design, and apply for game design jobs, and apply for playtesting jobs, and apply for playtesting volunteers. Like get yourself out there and learn everything you can about everything for whatever you're trying to do, whether it's art or game design or miniature making or sculpting, like whatever. Keep doing it, basically, and keep trying, because there's not a lot of positions for it. But if you don't apply, or you don't apply everywhere you can, every time you can, you'll never get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the, you know, the consistently work and push forward is good advice. The other thing that I would say, having, you know, been in the position of like hiring people and all that in the industry for over a decade now, is like focus in on what you want, right? Just don't apply for something or take a position with the intention of going somewhere else, right? Like one, it's not going to really be the dream job that you thought it would be, because surprisingly enough, you know, the game industry is like any other industry. When you have a job to do, you do that job. We don't all just hang out and like, you know, roll dice all day. So, you know, be honest with yourself, be true about what you want to do. And then like Pagani said, go out and do it and get better at it. Work hard at it, right? Like hard work is going to do more for you than anything else. And you're going to, you know, and the advice that I give everybody, regardless of whether you want to go to the gaming industry or not, it's like, you're going to fail way, way more than you'll ever succeed. But the fact is that every failure that you make is going to take you one step closer to success. So just don't stop, right? Like love your failures for what they are, which is a learning experience. And if you do that and you show resilience and you keep pushing forward, like that's going to resonate with people that you're making connections with and we're seeing you way more than anything else, right? And it's going to give you that leg up, because most people, when they fail once, they don't like it and they quit.
And that's a quick way never to get hired anywhere in any dream job. So build resilience, love failure, and like find what you want to do and drive for that. Don't try to like fake your way into it by taking something that you're not going to be happy with, because ultimately it's going to sour what could be a great experience.
I think that is an incredibly important point. Like if you want to be an artist, be an artist. Don't try and go for a job that's not art, basically. Because there's a lot of people in the industry that can do that. Because they just want to be in the industry, not in the industry doing what they want.
One piece of advice that I would give as well, granted I'm a retailer and not in the game making part of the industry, but one of the things that I think is important for people to know and understand is to have the clear expectation that you kind of touched on this a little bit, but you will be doing work and it will be hard. And
yes.
There will be times when you hate it, but it is still like you just need to understand that like people think, for example, that owning a game store is like this dream job that, you know, is sunflowers and lollipops. and I love my job and it's great. But it's a lot of work. So be aware of that.
Definitely.
All right. So next question, what can players expect in organized play support from Atomic Mass?
So the game's going to launch with organized play support on day one. We've miniatures players for a long time. Been part of the gaming industry for like ever. So we really value and understand the importance of organized play. I think the big thing with ours though is, again, kind of going back to some of the fundamental pillars of the game itself and then just our company ideals that we established when we set forth, is that our organized play is what we're calling play focused. And what that means is that there are no awards for winning the whole thing. The point of hobby games has always been to experience community with other people, to get with like-minded like players and hobbyists, and to just enjoy yourself, to get better, to work towards an ultimate goal that you'll never reach. That's the point of a hobby. Nobody goes out fly fishing in order to win fly fishing, right? Because it just doesn't happen. You get better all the time. So for us, it was really important that we kind of take organized play and we try something different with it. And we really put our money where our mouth was in terms of wanting the game to be about fun and community and doing so together. And so our organized play effectively just awards you for showing up and playing games. And everybody can walk away with the same awards that they play and they hobby. And that's kind of like the general gist. So we're going to have leagues where there'll be multi-week things. They're going to have a kind of a tied-in storyline, and they're going to have different scenarios and different rules and all that kind of stuff that you kind of expect from a narrative league. And then we're going to have a single day event, which is kind of our pseudo tournament event. So this is just show up, play the game stock as is. You're going to play for 3 rounds. Everybody's going to walk away with stuff when they play their games and paint their miniatures. And the nice thing is that because it's 3 rounds, you always know how long it's going to take. So you can kind of plan around it and you don't have to worry about, you know, being the best or losing your first round and then being like, well, why am I here? You're here to play games, right? You're here to have fun. So do that. And then the last one is what we're currently calling Story Days. And these are basically single day events that dive into the narrative or the characters of the Marvel Universe in a fun way. So they present unique scenarios. They have special like alternate character cards that represent the characters in that storyline or in that event from the Marvel Universe. And then they have a bunch of cool like alternate art cards and stuff that you can earn by playing games and having fun. Add anything else?
Yeah, I like to think of it not as like even the one-day tournament, quote-unquote, style event. Like, it's not you're showing up to show people that you're better than them, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's that you're showing up to experience this thing. And I think it's like you are here to experience the content of the game, not necessarily to win your games or to crush people, right? Like, that's never been our goal for this game and that kind of thing. And if people want to run events in stores that are tournaments, absolutely. Like, we're not going to dissuade you.
We're not going to come take your miniatures away. It's not one of our policies.
Shit,
so
will fly down to your store.
And I think the other really important thing to kind of talk about too is Priyani kind of mentioned how, and we've talked a little bit about how fun and the experience was core to the whole idea behind the game and what we were trying to build. But that doesn't mean that we were looking for a game that wasn't, you know, rules tight and sound, because to me, the most casual of games has the best rule set. Because the second that you get pulled out of the narrative or pulled out of the story or the action on the tabletop, because you don't know how something works or you have a rules question, and there's a weird interaction, like it falls apart, right?
And nobody enjoys that experience.
If the goal is to have you and your opponent or your opponents telling this awesome Marvel story together with your characters on the table as you're fighting back and forth, the last thing you want is for the film reel to break or the page to be missing in your comic book, because you have to finally come out of it and be like, okay, well, now we don't know what to do. What do we do? And now let's go back to the real world, right? The point, like the goal, is that that 90-minute experience is all in the tabletop and you're in it the whole time. And you just get to enjoy it with your opponent and, you know, try to claim victory. And even if you don't, have a great story afterwards and something that you can talk about and tell your friends or tell your spouse as she rolls her eyes at you. That might just be my life. I don't know.
One thing I appreciate about that is that, you know, I've played several games competitively, and the competitive players, I've had too many tournament organizers or event organizers who think about like, oh, you know, what are we going to do to incentivize the top players from coming in and playing? And you don't need that. And it's silly for you to think that you do, because they're going to show up and play, and they don't need another, you know, doodad on their wall or whatever. And so yeah. I think it's cool that you guys are approaching it that way.
And I'm really intrigued by the league ideas. And so could I just ask, is it safe to assume that those leagues are going to be based on some Marvel comic storylines?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, everything kind of has a foundation in the comic storylines. I think the fun thing is that we kind of get to interpret certain things in a different way sometimes, depending on how it fits. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything that we want to do, everything that we're planning to do, all has its roots, its foundations in the Marvel universe.
But you're not like stuck just retelling a story. You're gonna adapt it, is what you're saying. No, yeah, that makes complete sense.
We have the ability to adapt or to simply retell. You know, like one of the things I really love working with Marvel is the flexibility that they offer and the idea that, you know, they are a creative house. So they love it when people kind of iterate on the things that they do. And it's fun to see them get excited at our takes on the characters and how we've like changed something in a design to make it work for miniature. And then they see it and they're like, oh, that's really cool. You know, like Crossbones was one where we kind of took a bunch of different elements across the board and made a somewhat unique design, a Marvel Crisis Protocol design, and showing it to the Marvel people and having them be like, this is one of the best Crossbones we love it. It's so cool. And, you know, that's rewarding, right? Especially for somebody who wants to draw comics but can't draw Stickman. You know, I can at least like help create this new part of the Marvel universe.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. Like in all the comics about Crossbones I've read, he always has a big old gun, or, you know, he's always mowing through people. So to see him basically punchinating dudes left and right is like, I was like, all right, that's dope too. It works, right? He's a big scary merc.
He's a big scary dude with huge fists. So
big old fists.
Very huge.
Awesome, guys. Thank you. So the final question we have is kind of related, that, you know, Marvel Comics is this monstrosity of characters and scenarios and teams. And you guys, I am sure you've noticed on the internet, there's lots of people that have been asking like, oh, when is my favorite character coming out? When is this team coming out? So I just wanted to ask, is there any methodology that guides which characters or teams you prioritize to put in the game first before others?
It's all based on my personal opinion. No. You're amazing. That's just where I ended it.
Good day.
Good day. Interview over. No, I mean, some of it is based, you know, obviously in conversation with Marvel. Some of it is based, you know, quite honestly, on our personal opinions and the things that we think would be cool, or the things that we think would be good for the game, right? So it's a mixture of a lot of different elements that come together. And obviously, you know, if I had my way, right, all the characters would be out right away, because it's really hard to look at a schedule and be like, well, I love this person, but we can't get to them for like 4 years, but I want them now.
Yeah.
But, you know, what do you do, right? So it's really intriguing, right? Because, and I think that's another amazing facet, is the fact that there's so many awesome characters that you run into that situation that you can be like, well, there's a whole faction of people who love, you know, Squirrel Girl comes up a lot.
there's a whole bunch of Squirrel Girl like love, right? Yeah, totally. I get it. But, you know, at the same time, there's a whole faction that loves this other character over here that wants them just as much. So how do you fit that in? And then, you know, you figure that out, right? And the goal is to get to everyone. I want everyone to have everyone they want because I want them all.
It'll take a while.
It'll just take a while, you know?
Yeah. You've got to wait.
Yeah, it's just patience. Patience is important, but it's hard. Patience isn't very fun.
That should be the title of this podcast. Patience isn't very fun.
There you go. But my Marvel Crisis Protocol is. Let's put that on
there. There we go. Awesome. Well, thank you again very much, guys, for doing this podcast. We appreciate it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah, it was a great time. Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and we are ready to start talking about the comic book story arc that Greg selected for this first inaugural podcast. So, Greg, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about the comics you selected?
Yeah, absolutely. So the story arc is generally called Avengers Under Siege. It's this classic Avengers story of them getting outwitted by a villain. And what's really cool is that, so it's Baron Zemo, and the overall idea is that the Avengers are defeated, and it's not just that they're defeated, like they lose a battle. It's that Baron Zemo destroys their home. He comes in and he takes it over, and he's torturing, you know, people, and he's just completely taking the Avengers down in every way.
In the Marvel Unlimited app, this is listed as Avengers 273, and then it says kind of in parentheses 1963. And my understanding is that that's meaning that this Avengers storyline started in 1963, and then the comics we read were episodes 273 through 277, and the 273 released in November of 1986. Is that correct?
Yes. No, that's right. So it's, yeah. And
I was a little bit confused when I first started, because there was a part of me that thought that this had actually released in, you know, 1960, whatever. And so that's not the case.
Yeah, and I think it's important that we do talk about that, because we're going to be using the Marvel Unlimited app,
right,
which is a subscription service that Marvel Comics has, and it basically lets you read almost every old comic available. There's a few gaps that they're actually constantly like filling in gaps. But the cool part is they put in all the classic and big storylines first. So a lot of what they're filling in is stories that not as many people have interest in.
Sure.
And the way this classifies it is every time they restart the Avengers comic, you'll see a new date of the when it started. And from that point, it's basically monthly until they cancel it or restart the comic with a new number one.
Right.
And it does get kind of confusing, because sometimes they'll be, you know, they want to do an Avengers issue 500, so they'll go back to the original numbering, or they'll count every single Avengers comic that was ever made and say, oh, this is issue 500. Huh. So the numbering does get kind of complicated.
Sure.
This is Avengers 273 to 277. And if you went to a bookstore and bought it, it would be called Avengers Under Siege. You know, I think one of the main reasons that this really stood out to me was that it's a Baron Zemo focus, and that would be a really good thing to focus on first, because he is a villain that a lot of people don't know much about.
Yeah, so when I saw the core box that they had selected the characters for Crisis Protocol, it did seem kind of odd to me that they included Baron Zemo in the box, because as someone who I've watched all of the MCU movies many times, it seemed kind of strange that they would pick him as one of the starting 10 characters.
Yeah, I think him and Crossbones are the two
yeah.
where you were like, them? Really? But it's important to like recognize that in the comics, Zemo and Crossbones are like really big and important Captain America villains.
So, I guess why don't we go ahead and give a overview of what happens real quick in this set of comics?
Yeah. So in this comic, Zemo has assembled a new group of villains that are called the Masters of Evil. He's not the one who did this first. It was actually his dad had originally created the Masters of Evil, and it's basically just the evil version of the Avengers. It's a collection of villains.
Except it seems like the requirements on membership are not very strict, because it seems like everyone and their dog is joined the Masters of Evil.
Yeah, it's they're definitely trying to recruit as many villains as they can, I think. And it's even, you can clearly see that like Zemo is holding the team together by being the scariest person in the room.
Yeah, or one thing that was interesting, and I haven't read as many comics as you, but there were a lot of thought bubbles in this comic series.
Yeah, this is kind of an aspect of like older comics. Even up until the 90s, there were a lot of comics where it's like they needed to constantly show you what the heroes and villains are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't figure out a way to show you what they're saying, or just show with the action. As we go into like newer comics, you'll see that less and less.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I noticed as someone who I have read some modern comics, and it's definitely not something that you saw to the extent that that happened in this comic book arc. And one of the things that was interesting is that there were a lot of thought bubbles with the villains basically thinking about, like, you know, how can I take over from Zemo, or how can I keep this other villain in place? And I thought that was kind of an interesting part of this story arc.
Yeah. The ones that always get me are when it's like a character just thinking about the thing that the art shows.
sure,
There's one like where Thor sees the Wasp and Black Knight, and he literally says, "By my hammer, Black Knight and the Wasp." Like, the art isn't enough to show you who we're looking at. There's lots of unnecessary thought bubbles, and I think it's really just a result of it was one of those things that was really common in older comics, and it took them a while to get out of that bad habit. So
basically, Baron Zemo assembles the Masters of Evil. He has a long-standing grudge versus Captain America and versus the Avengers, mm-hmm. and he hatches a plot on how he is going to overthrow them, and then attempts to enact it. And then how does that work out for him, Greg?
I mean, they succeed. I think it's in the third or fourth issue, they've taken over the mansion. They've
multiple Avengers captured.
Yeah, they have multiple Avengers captured. They have one of them in a coma in the hospital. They are literally torturing the Avengers butler in front of Captain America just to hurt Captain America. And I think this is as close as anybody gets to like actually demoralizing the Avengers. And, you know, I think it mostly falls apart because their team is so is, you know, a bunch of people trying to trick Baron Zemo, or Baron Zemo keeps like abandoning people, and he's this really sneaky, plotty guy, so nobody trusts him, and he doesn't trust anybody else. So it does. They do eventually get defeated, thanks to the Wasp and Ant-Man coming and freeing people, and Captain America leads the counterattack, and Thor shows up, which they were not expecting. So, you know, I think it's a really good, like, they defeated the Avengers, but then the Avengers quickly took it back. But even then, you know, it was
kind of a classic story of the Masters of Evil won a battle, and then the Avengers win the war.
Yeah. Eventually. But it's, you know, it's interesting too, because it's like the Avengers were humbled. I think it's just in the first issue, the Avengers have all these defense mechanisms that the Masters of Evil just knock over pretty easily. And so the Avengers thought they were, you know, this bastion of strength. So I think it was really interesting to show them get knocked down. It's kind of cool to see the villains winning and being extremely confident. And yeah, it is considered to be one of those like classic Avengers storylines that it defined a lot of things later on. Like it defined even 20 years later, the team we see as the Masters of Evil, like that team is being repeated in different places and different formats.
So you've answered this a little bit, or given some parts of this answer already in the synopsis, but why did you end up picking this story arc as our first one to go over?
Yeah, no, I think I wanted a story arc that showed Baron Zemo going up against Captain America. To me, I really liked Baron Zemo. I really liked Zemo in the Captain America Civil War movie, but he's extremely different from the comic Zemo. So comic Zemo is, he's a Cobra Commander mad scientist with a grudge to pick against Captain America. And I think like a lot of this story was him just trying to show that how amazingly smart and
how much he's going to outthink everyone.
Yeah. You know, like separating the Avengers, and, you know, he had to stop Captain Marvel. And so he had a plan, not just to stop Captain Marvel, but to stop the other villain from using Blackout against him. And so there were all these like plots within plots that are really fun, and really represent like how Zemo leads his teams.
Yeah. And real quick, some people might not even realize this, but Baron Zemo is in the MCU movies.
Mm-hmm.
He is in the Civil War movie, and he's the character who realizes that he cannot defeat the Avengers, and so he's going to pit them against themselves and have them destroy themselves. That's one of my favorite MCU movies. I think he's, you know, obviously an important part of that, but he is kind of just like this background character who is plotting but doesn't really have even really superpowers per se that I can think of. It's more just I'm going to get my revenge.
Yeah, on the Avengers. And right. And I mean, it is worth saying that movie Zemo is going to be returning to the MCU in the Winter Soldier and the Falcon series, and they're teasing he's going to wear his like purple hood like in the comics.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that could be, I don't know if it'll be building up Zemo for like bigger things, or if it'll just be a villain that Winter Soldier and Falcon fight.
So do you have any comments on the creative team behind this story arc?
I mean, the art is Tom Palmer, and Roger Stern was the Avengers writer. Oh man, I think for 15 years. And like they were really like, both of them were just on the team for so long that they did have a lot of influence on changing it. To me, neither of them really stand out too much on their own, but like this comic is, in my opinion, it's the result of like you working as a team for a really long time and getting to know the characters really, really well. You can start doing things that kind of break the mold. And that's, to me, that's what this is, right? This is not the Avengers responding to a crisis or the Avengers stopping a villain. This is a villain coming into your house and like breaking everything to mess with you. So, I really just think this is one of those results of like people who grind at comics and make consistent and good storylines.
Awesome. So this podcast episode one and the bonus episode are going to focus, our main focus is on Baron Zemo. Mm-hmm. What's some additional background that you can provide on him that isn't in necessarily this comic arc?
I mean, Zemo is, there's a lot of like backstory between him and Captain America that's in the story.
Yeah.
I would say some stuff that isn't really obviously apparent is, like in the game, you notice Zemo has a sword. He is a master swordsman. He is a strategic genius. So like his combat abilities in the comics are probably coming close to Captain America level. He has a lot of like super science things that are not shown in here. Like for example, his father was a genius inventor who created, a drug that made you age slower. So him and his father don't really like get old in the comics. They're just constantly at peak human level. So it can kind of ignore the fact that like this is Zemo, the second Baron Zemo, and he should probably be about 70 years old if he's still alive. And so, you know, we don't need to worry about that because his dad was a genius. Sometimes he uses this thing called Adhesive X, which is like a super glue that can stick you instantly. And it's like the strongest adhesive known to the world. Zemo's been around long enough that he is the core villain in like a ton of different storylines. One that is really, really popular is a really cool one called Thunderbolts, where he basically gets a bunch of the Masters of Evil to pretend like they're a superhero team after the Avengers go missing. And so he pretends to be this hero called Citizen V, who is basically Batman with a sword.
Huh.
And he wears like a, you know, he wears like an American flag cape. And so he's got all these ex-villains pretending to be superheroes. And as the story goes on, the other villains really like being heroes, and so they end up reforming themselves. Huh. And Zemo is like trying to manipulate them so that he can keep controlling them. So it's like there's some really amazing Zemo comics. I think it's just important to realize that like no matter what Zemo's doing, he's manipulating other characters in the stories. He's trying to exert his own power. And like we can really see that in this story.
So this comic book arc has a big ensemble of characters,
mm-hmm.
both heroes and villains. This could maybe be a discussion for both of us, but who did we see as the main characters of the storyline, and what did we think of them?
In my opinion, the story is kind of about Captain America. Because if we look at like the emotions, it's Captain America. He is being outsmarted. He is being captured. He has to watch Jarvis get tortured. And then like at the end, you can see how upset he is that the only home he knew in the modern age is destroyed because they knocked down Avengers Mansion and all of his like historical relics from his life before World War II are destroyed. And I really like it because it kind of shows that, you know, even when a hero can win, he can still be on the losing side. Captain America definitely lost a lot in this story.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. Another one that was interesting was that, it seemed like the Wasp was a central figure in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So heading into this Avengers team was a configuration that, having been someone who is mainly familiar through the MCU, this Avengers team had a lot of people, a lineup I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Wasp at this point is the leader of the Avengers. One of the very first Avengers that you're introduced to is Hercules.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that Hercules was necessarily a main character of the storyline, but I didn't even know that Hercules was a comic book character.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's so, a big Avenger.
Yeah, that was interesting. It was also interesting. This is a more minor character, maybe a second tier. it seems like there were maybe first tier, second tier, and three tier characters. Mm-hmm. And one that was interesting was Mr. Hyde showed up a fair bit as a villain.
Yeah.
And he was another one. I had no idea that he was a Marvel villain.
Mm-hmm. He's one who I feel like they kind of got rid of him and stopped bringing him up because he's such a silly character.
Yeah.
Because he very much is just like, oh, it's Mr. Hyde from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Okay.
Yeah. But and it kind of seems like the three main characters to me were probably Zemo, Captain America, and the Wasp. Would you say that's fair, or am I miscategorizing anyone?
No, I mean, I think there are definitely, you know, we alternate between main characters, right? That's totally fair to say. When it's the villains, it's either Zemo or Moonstone.
Right.
We see the perspective of, and then when we see the heroes, we either see Wasp, Captain America, or Hercules. And Hercules is only relevant in that first issue.
Right.
And then he's hospitalized. So
overall, what did you think of the main characters that were in this story arc?
I really think Zemo and Captain America shine. The Wasp is really reactive, and I do feel like it kind of set up a couple plot lines almost that we didn't get to see. Like, I think in the first issue, Hercules kind of expresses that he's angry that he takes orders from a woman.
Yeah.
And we never get to see where that goes because it's obviously, you know, going to be addressed in a future issue. And I do feel like a lot of it is the Wasp is just looking out for her team. So she's responding from going to the hospital to coming back to the mansion. So to me, I feel like a lot of the focus is just Captain America and Zemo. And I really like how Zemo and Captain America are shown. I like Zemo as the plotting evildoer who's, you know, doesn't trust anybody. And, you know, Captain America is Captain America. So anything that makes him look less perfect is probably going to be, you know, it lets you see that he's a person. It lets us relate to him. And I like it a lot. What did you think of them?
I enjoyed it. It was interesting to, and honestly, this is basically my first main exposure to the comic book version of Zemo. And I thought that it was a really good introduction to him. So I did enjoy that.
Yeah. Good.
So did you feel like this comic book arc, did you feel that it was more story based or that it was more character driven?
I think it really was story based. I think the whole point of this was to show, you know, bad guys taking over Avengers Mansion. So I think, you know, the event of the heroes losing was the point.
That's kind of interesting because I think I probably would have gone with character driven as my selection. And part of the reason why I would have picked that is it felt like the character was being driven, or sorry, the story was being driven by Zemo's need for revenge and also kind of for his desire to show that he's smarter than everyone else and to have these plots that succeed in destroying his enemies. And so that's probably the take that I would have gone with it.
Yeah, I mean, I can see your point of view. I feel like the story was really just the conceit of their emotions. I think the whole point was to destroy Avengers Mansion and to have the Avengers lose. So, but you know, I think you're totally right that they definitely used Zemo's revenge and his, like, you know, you killed my dad and I'm going to get revenge for that.
So this will be the closing out question for this part of the podcast, but what did we end up liking the most about this arc of comic books?
Personally, I really liked how it has a solid beginning, middle, and end.
Uh-huh.
I feel like a lot of times with comic books, you either have, like, you have a huge buildup and then a sudden climax and a quick ending, or the other way around, right? You start at the high point in the beginning and you just ride it. But I feel like this story was really cool, how we got to see Zemo and the Masters of Evil kind of like planning. We got to see them taking small steps before they take over Avengers Mansion. And even then, they're working hard to separate the Avengers, to trap Captain Marvel, to eliminate what are the obvious threats so that they can like do their evil doing and capture everybody. And I really liked how it's paced. I feel like it's just a really good story arc.
I think the two things that I liked the most about it is that it's always nice when there's a really good low point in a storyline,
mm-hmm.
and it creates a lot of dramatic tension, and then it also gives you a good chance for the heroes to fight back. And so I thought that was really good in the story arc. There were some pretty decent lows that went on. And the other thing that I liked a lot is something that you touched on already, but at the end when Captain America is like looking at his torn pictures or some of the things that are connecting him to his past that have been destroyed because of what the Masters of Evil did, I thought that was a really effective and really emotional part of the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, seeing it's not often that you see superheroes, you know, crying over personal mementos, and you, like, we were given a really good payout about, you know, the personal toll that Zemo took on Cap.
Okay, well, that is going to basically wrap up our first episode of our main cast. And so, Greg, why don't we go ahead and preview what people should read for their, if they want to follow along in episode 2.
Yeah, so we are going to be reading another classic Avengers storyline. This one is not as dated as the Avengers Under Siege storyline, but we're going to be reading Avengers Ultron Unlimited. And I am pausing because I'm struggling to find the exact issues. Sorry. So it's going to be Avengers issues 19 to 22. And it's the Avengers that was published. It started in 1999, I believe.
Yeah, and we'll have posted on our social media the image of it in Marvel Unlimited. It looks like it's...
Oh, 1998.
Yep, 1998 numbers 19 to
22. Mm-hmm.
So we'll cover that story arc of comics, and then we will talk about Ultron in the gameplay sections. And so we'd love for you guys to go ahead and read those before our next episode and then give it a listen. So real quick, we'll give a preview of what we're going to talk about in our bonus episode. We're going to continue discussing this comic book arc and some of the things that we thought about it. And then we'll focus in the second segment on gameplay about
Baron Zemo.
Yeah, Baron Zemo. And so the bonus episode, that's something that is available to our Patreon backers. Another benefit that Patreon backers have is that they gain early access to both the main cast and the bonus episode that we put out. And so by the time this first episode is live, if you back us at our basic level on Patreon, you will be able to listen to the bonus episode of this episode 1, but you'll also gain early access to episode 2 and the bonus episode for that. And then 1 week after this, you will have, everyone will gain access to the main episode of episode 2, and those who are backing us on Patreon will gain early access to episode 3. And so you'll have rolling early access to the content that we're doing, and also access to our bonus episodes. And if you go to the Patreon page, you'll see outlined all the benefits that you can receive from the two backer levels that we have available. And so we wanted to thank everyone who is decided to back us on Patreon. You guys are what makes this possible and what makes it all go. And so thank you very much. And we hope that you guys end up finding it worth your time and money to support us. So Greg, did you have anything else that you want to say before we ended this first episode?
No, I mean, you ended it very succinctly. It's a pleasure to be doing this, and thank you everybody who supports us.
Yeah, thank you very much for listening, and we hope that you'll check us out on Patreon.